Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
I think you are being interviewed by Fred Film Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some people have already gone through that, and some are going over these next days. Mm-hmm. And they want to start a program on accessibility for cinema. Okay. And so they asked me, can you record maybe the session and maybe some of the feedback that you can have from the guys that are taking part in the workshop.
So maybe you should not put it on the table because you were here on...
Like this?
Sounds constantly. Yeah. It's really sensitive.
Yeah?
You should maybe put it on there, on the...
Here?
TV, yeah.
Hopefully this is going to work.
Kind of directed to...
Oh, like... Yeah.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So, before coming here this morning, I attended a session in Hotel Excelsior, down there, on accessibility for cinema. So it's one of the big issues coming up. And by accessible cinema, we normally mean cinema that is accessible for everyone, for all different categories, including people that cannot see or cannot fully see, and people that cannot hear. There was also, in this session this morning, a lot of talking about autistic people and how they enjoy cinema, entertainment in general. And... well, basically, today we're going to concentrate on deafness and blindness and how these people falling within these categories relate to cinema. So, what is accessible cinema? A cinema that tries to reach out to everyone. Why do we want to make cinema accessible for all if we want to?
Because I think it's a good idea also, considering there is a kind of art and entertainment, like to make it possible to give accessibility to everyone.
Yes.
But also, it's a huge economical factor, so if you make it accessible to more people, you will get more revenues.
Yes.
So it's also that.
Yes.
Yeah, from an economy.
The other hard side of it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, well, if you think of deafness, I'm going to give you some figures. There's a lot of people that are affected by hearing impairments, if not fully deaf, but, you know, or people that turn deaf later on in life, like my dad is 85 and he's been deaf for about 20 years now. He was never deaf when he was young, but slowly, by the time he retired and the job he had, he became deaf. So, you know, this is just one of the million cases that we come across. And basically, one of the reasons is that we all deserve being able to enjoy entertainment, all of us. It's actually part of the United Nations Conventions for Human Rights that was released a few years back. And yeah, it's included in there. Yeah. And it says that everyone has the right to enjoy entertainment in all its forms. So that's it. Accessible cinema is... Well, one thing we have to say, first of all, is that each country develops its own program and its own way to offer accessibility to cinema. For example, on television in Europe, one of the leading countries is the UK. They provide a lot of accessibility to whatever they broadcast as for television. Switzerland is a country that does a lot for some reasons. For several reasons. Although it's a small country, they really invest a lot in accessibility. I don't know about the Netherlands, Italy. Television, we don't have that much in terms of accessibility for blind people. It's about, I think, right now, 500 hours of accessible video materials for the blind, whereas for the deaf, we have 70-75% of whatever is broadcast by main channels that is accessible for the deaf with captions. What about, well, France? France is doing quite a lot. I don't have figures for France. You live in Paris, didn't you?
I live in Paris, but I never, ever watch TV, so I wouldn't be able to tell you. But I do know that in most theaters, and certainly the Cinémathèque française, there are very often there are screenings which say with assistance for the hearing impaired.
Yeah. Every country has its own regulation. Belgium is doing quite a lot, for example. Mm-hmm. In the UK, television offers, I think, 95% of what is broadcast by the main channels, including private channels, with subtitles, and audio description comes for about 30% of what is broadcast by, again, Channel 4 and all the main channels. I think the landscape is going to become more homogeneous in the years to come because of companies like Netflix. Netflix started in the US with accessibility, offering audio description and subtitles for the deaf, I think a couple of years back. We know because, well, one of the people that are in charge of language services or accessibility services for Netflix in LA was trained in the UK in the MA that I'm teaching. She wasn't a student of mine, but she was in the program. And so she was hired by Netflix, and she pointed out that this was an extra opportunity. So now Netflix is starting with accessibility, audio description, and subtitles for the deaf all over Europe. I think in Italy they're bound to start in October, offering audio description and subtitles for the deaf. So I guess that since Netflix is going to do it all over Europe, slowly, I think Spain is doing the same, France and so on, this is going to affect all other TV channels and even cinemas, you know. Otherwise, Netflix is going to take all of the share. So I think, you know, they're going to stir the pot quite a lot, as it's happening even in cinema production, as you know. So, right now, in a lot of countries, you can go to some cinemas and enjoy audio description and subtitles, but subtitles are there for you to see, and audio description, you can have headsets and listen to it. For example, in the UK, I know there's about 500 cinemas where you can do it. In Italy, this is still sort of limited, but there are two applications for smartphones that you can download, and you go to your cinema. You can buy, I mean, for some films, not all films, but selected films, you can have your audio description on your mobile, and you pay for it, but you get a discount at the ticket desk in cinema. So it's basically free. Well, for whom? People in accessibility studies in Europe and beyond tend to say more and more that accessibility is for everyone. Think of captions. I don't know what experience you have, but I go to the UK very often, and they had a few years back this law passed whereby, like, screens that are in public places have to be muted. And the subtitles have to be on. Like if you fly into Heathrow or Stansted in London, that's what you have all around you. Why? I mean, you don't need the volume because they're going to announce like flights, changes or whatever. So you have the screens with the news reports or whatever is on and the subtitles. It means you can access the information even when you're listening to announcements or whatever. And I have this in gyms, supermarkets in the UK. The US is doing the same. I was in the US 3 months ago and it was the same. Public places have screens that are muted with subtitles on so that you can access the information. And that's not for the deaf, that's for everyone. So there's this increasing tendency to realize that access services can benefit everyone. Audio description, that is for people with sight impairments, can be of use for other people too. Well, first of all, you can be completely blind or partially sighted in different ways. It can be something that helps people that don't speak a language very well. It sort of helps as a guidance. You might be driving and not be able to look at the screen, and maybe you want to follow your own program, TV series or whatever, so you have the soundtrack plus the audio description, so that you don't see the screen, but you can follow. So the idea is to expand the borders of accessibility beyond sensory impairments. Again, the positive side of all of this is that if we have this kind of line of thinking, we think in terms of inclusion. Like, you know, if you're blind, you're just like me. I can benefit from your services that were thought, that were developed for you, myself in a different way, but still. And that's a tendency that the European Union has been advocating for in the past years, which is fair. some figures here. 1 billion people live with some form of disability in the world, so it's actually quite big. 1 in 6 people worldwide is affected by sensory impairment, which means hearing or sight loss. And these figures come from ITU, is the United Nations Agency for Accessibility, working on accessibility mainly.
But like sight loss, what do you mean?
There are international parameters, and also at national level, every country has parameters to define what is considered severe sight loss. So, like, I think in Italy, and maybe the other countries are sort of there too, if you have lost 70% or more of your sight, you're considered visually impaired, legally recognized as such. So, but this, you know, that's percentages that define sight loss. But I guess when you have sight loss for, like, I have a friend who's like 60% blind, but he pretends he can have a normal life, and he does have a normal life, but still, he's visually impaired. So, you know, then there's this problem of acknowledging your own disability or ignoring it. I have another friend, he's, I think, 85% blind, not totally blind, so he sees something.
But blind that can be, like, through the glasses or through contact lens, like...
The 85, yeah, well, the 85% guy has glasses, but I don't think that helps that much. You know, what helps for him is that he sees shapes and different light intensity, so he can move around and do things. Not everything, he cannot drive, definitely, but he can go and use public transport by moving without a cane or a dog or, you know. There was a lady there at the meeting in Hotel Excelsior. She's totally blind, and she had a dog. Plus, different types of disabilities can also be referred to the fact that you are born blind, so you grow up and you start moving around because you're blind from birth. Or like this lady, she's more or less my age, I think, 45 or something, and she became blind like 15 years ago. So that's a completely different thing. Like, she finds it very difficult to move around on her own because she didn't grow up like that, okay. And, you know, sight loss is very different. So I guess there are figures or percentages that are established by the United Nations or European Union, the European Blind Union, the European Deaf Union, to define what is a sensory impairment of some kind. Nearly 50 million Americans experience intermediate to severe hearing loss, which is quite a lot. Well, this is a problem that we have around us, definitely. An example of what we are going to mainly focus on today. Well, first of all, you have a caption there that we mentioned yesterday. And there what you have is a picture of a lady in a cinema theater with headset on, listening to audio description. Let's see this, and then you tell me what you notice. Let's see if it works today.
A sliding advertising panel on a city bus stop changes its display to the logo for Bus Stop Films, Inclusive Filmmaking. A man holding a briefcase inhales deeply. The interviewer. Lift doors open and the man, who's in his 30s, straightens by and steps out into a slick reception area. There's a woman sitting at a desk adorned with an expensive floral arrangement, and she looks up and smiles.
Hi, I'm Sam. I'm here for the interview with Mr. Dixon.
Yeah, sure thing. Just take a seat and he'll be out in a minute.
Thomas sits on an armchair in the nearby waiting area and glances out the window for a moment, before taking a folder from his briefcase. Another young man in a suit is sitting opposite him, toying with an MP3 player.
Did you notice anything so far?
Well, they say the things before they happen, so you don't have to rush when they talk. If I sound a bit fake, but
no.
They're a bit ahead of the story.
That's one main thing without the description. I mean, if they are going to talk afterwards, or there's some kind of audio information coming up, you need to foreground the information in the description, otherwise it gets lost if you have space.
I'm sorry, I'm late. I thought it was
2:30.
I'm very sorry.
Sorry. We didn't really go any, that much far.
Okay, I've seen this video.
Really? Oh, good. Have you seen it?
No. But also, the thing that strikes me is that the voice is actually, it's coordinated with the mood and tone of the film itself. It's not just like a bland description.
Yeah.
The tone and kind of pacing and
that is a very good point.
The intonation of it is just
that's a very good point. Yeah, choosing voices for audio description is a very delicate matter. Sometimes, well, you normally say that you want a voice that sort of matches the video. So when it's, well, I think this is quite a good voice for this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, I was asked by a company in Egypt to help them find the right voices for, they have audio described, I think, 40 Disney films. And some are like Cinderella, and then you have Cars, like so very different styles. And you sort of listen to demos for different voices and decided, but when it's like Cinderella or Frozen, you might tend to want to go for what, female or male? Although it's a tricky issue because you have mostly female voices in the film itself. So, I mean, if you really want to make a difference, you should be going for a male voice. But since Frozen is definitely a girly kind of thing, so what you normally do is you go for a female voice different from voices that are in the film itself. And yeah, choosing voices is always very tricky. Anything else about subtitles or captions?
Yeah, it's a different color to make sure it's not, it's not a subtitle. Yeah.
Let's have a look at a bit.
After.
Thomas frowns. Raising his eyebrows, Thomas returns to his folder.
Raising his eyebrows. I'm pointing this out to you because this is one of the most difficult things with audio description. You always say that you want to be objective in your descriptions, which is virtually impossible because what we see is what we see is not just what our eyes record, but it's what gets processed by our minds, and our minds function with our experiences, and my experience is different from yours and yours and yours and yours. So being objective is... So
I kind of think, though, it must be the same process as the screenplay, actually, where you're not supposed to describe what the reaction is. You're not supposed to say, well, he's really disappointed or frustrated with something.
Yeah.
You just describe the actual physical thing.
That's it.
So that's
perfectly. Perfect in line with what I was going to say. You normally want to avoid using adjectives that might be your own choice rather than what was meant by the director in the first place. So that's why you describe what happens with the face rather than using an adjective and saying, he's worried, he's sad, he's whatever. Yeah. Although sometimes it's not easy, but and having the director's intervention would be great, but we'll see in a minute that doesn't happen very often. Okay. A growing tendency in practice and even research throughout Europe, but also beyond, is towards accessible filmmaking, which means producing films which are accessible from the onset. They are produced as accessible products. And by accessible, I mean also several languages already being considered as part of the production process, rather than being something that happens in post-production, because that's what normally happens still quite a lot. You produce a film in your own language, multiple languages or whatever you have, and then you think that it has to be translated into several languages and possibly made accessible. So there's this large group of scholars and some directors advocating more and more for accessible filmmaking, making films that are thought of as accessible products from the very production stage. This is important for raising awareness. You raise awareness with directors that if they take into account accessibility, even in different languages, as we were saying yesterday, when they are producing the film, that might help because, you know, they know that this is going to be important for the distribution of the film anyway. Costs are not additional, not on top of production costs, but they become part of the production process. And it's not tiring to work on making a film accessible later on because it's all part of the production process. I have to say, I've worked in accessibility for live performances a lot, and in that case, accessibility, even different languages, different language versions, is part of the production process because a live performance is happening there. So you go into a theater and you work with the directors and it's much more interactive and cooperative. Whereas with films, that doesn't happen very often. Sometimes I've had the opportunity to work on audio description and then send it to the director to check. And some of them are like, wow, but this is like looking at my films with someone else's eyes. So why don't I provide my own vision, my own ideas? So sometimes you get to have the screenplay, which is already, you have notes and descriptions and you can use those. This is just some figures that I stole from a colleague, and he pointed out recently at a meeting that translation and accessibility services, when it comes to top-grossing films, account for 0.1 to maximum 1% of the budget of an average film production. Normally, over half of the revenue of top-grossing and award-winning Hollywood films come from foreign territories. So if you look at the figures for foreign-grossed, dubbed or subtitled versions of Harry Potter, Spider-Man, and so on, revenues coming from versions in different languages amount to 83% for Harry Potter.
I'm not sure I understand that, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, is the foreign-grossed dubbed or subtitled within the first statistic,
yes.
We go inside the 67%,
yes.
And so, and 83% of those that are abroad
are from translated versions.
Okay.
Yeah. So this goes inside this one, and it's 83% of foreign gross coming from dubbed or subtitled versions and not original versions, which is, you know, quite a lot. And
I mean, but do not subtitled versions count as original versions? Because it's either dubbed or original with subtitles, isn't it?
Yeah. But an original with subtitles still carries a translation. And for example, you are originally from Bulgaria. Imagine an American film reaching cinemas in your country with subtitles. Probably part of the audience can just follow the film in the original language, but a lot of them will be relying on subtitles anyway.
Yeah,
and
course.
That accounts for distribution through translation.
Of course, but then I guess my question is, where are the other 17%? Like, because obviously when you export a film, it doesn't reach theaters in its original version without subtitles.
Well, it does in some countries.
Just the original version with no subtitles or nothing.
Yeah.
Do they actually do that?
Yeah. Some countries do. These are figures that were released officially, so I just stole it from a colleague, so probably that's what it is, you know. And we were talking about screenings in the original versions in some countries, in selected areas or in selected cities, whereas the figure that you have on the far right really refers to translated versions, both subtitled and dubbed, and with dubbing you also refer to voiceover versions that we mentioned yesterday. SDH, as they call them in the UK, subtitles for the deaf and hard of hearing, or captions, as they call them in America. I have these four images here to show you that there's this also increasing tendency to play around with the captions, and you can use them in creative ways. I guess there has been this tendency to acknowledge their usefulness and the fact that they really are important. And since they have to be there, why don't we play around with them and, you know, make them part of the creative production in some way? And you can do that. This is like, to me, this looks like a typical old-fashioned type of captions. Whereas here you can play, you know, with the positions. Here you can add a line with a red backdrop. And here you really go creative and move them around. And it becomes part of your product, entertaining product. I don't know if you know that, for example, Netflix, for subtitles, I think both interlingual and intralingual, is now working with dynamic titles. Have you seen that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, for some of their series, not all of them, I think the most important ones, that say the old ones like Breaking Bad, those that have been around for a while, Orange is the New Black and everything, what they do is... they don't just keep the subtitles here, but if the character is speaking here, the subtitle goes here, and then the character, second character is there, so the subtitle appears there. So normally it follows the people and the voices. It's happening more and more. Well, you can, I don't know about every...
That's useful, like for like deaf people, but like for me it would be annoying.
Also. I know.
Like I agree with the director. Say like the written part is like changing my product, changing my artwork. So if you put like a written part here and then here, you cannot like figure out before how it's gonna be. Like if it is in the bottom, okay, it's alright. Like you can manage it, but like on the screen, it's really like.
What do you think about this? You know, having like this guy is talking,
like that,
and you have to subtitle.
I don't like at all. Like
this is a bit big.
Yeah, it's like also the background is black on the subtitles.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's like 1/3 of the screen that is occupied, isn't it?
Too much.
It changes the whole perception. I think the best one I've seen was something like the bottom one, but it was on the black border behind. And it was transparent if it touched the And usually the sound is on the left hand side, and the actual thing that is being said is on the right hand side.
Yeah.
Actually, I think though there's a kind of a tendency of the top two ones have become almost like
these two.
Like it's kind of almost like a postmodernist fashion now to make it in some kind of video and just flash lots of captions in a kind of exaggerated way. That's something that people actually do a lot for. Like,
I was going to ask Netflix, actually. I really want to send an email to a colleague that works as a consultant in Netflix to ask why they made this decision. There must be a reason. I don't think they just decided, you know, one day someone wakes up and says, okay, let's change the whole thing. Plus, again, as I was saying, they are doing it with selected products so far, and the old ones, not the new ones. So my idea so far is that perhaps they want to try out new techniques. And again, I also think that since they know that subtitles are not open, but they are closed, so they are an option for you to open up. If you open them, it means you need them. So, you know, it's your own choice to have them.
But they shouldn't be destroying them.
No. What I want to do is I want to carry out this study with a tool that I will be presenting in a while that tracks eye movements on screens and then also tests comprehension, because, you know, I think it takes time to get used to having this, like, constantly on the screen. And I think that getting used to that, travelling around, takes... definitely more time, but I think more effort, because it's unpredictable. You're there and you're like looking and waiting for the subtitle to pop up.
As a person who need, no, I don't need them, but I find them useful. I want them to be in the same position so I know where to look if I need it.
Mm. Yeah,
like
well.
If it, and usually the left hand corner is useful.
As I was saying, they are doing it more and more. So I guess there's a reason behind it. I was told that they were doing it on a sort of regular basis in the US by an American friend. And then I had a look at Italian TV series, and Netflix is doing it here. So I guess this is happening. And again, is it because they want to go creative? Is it because they want to experiment with something new? I don't know. But well, we'll find out. Contests of applications for captions. Cinema, yeah. Television and public screens, I already gave you my example. I think that's very useful, to be honest. Live shows, you have captions for live shows. They are live captions. Conferences and meetings, this is used more and more. Have you had that experience? I think it was here, we discussed it, in Sala Grande for the opening speeches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why did they decide to have captions? Well, first of all, for a translation, if you need it.
Yeah, I think, considering that it's an international festival,
yeah.
It's really useful, like, sort of like a translation in some way. Also because, I don't know if anyone doesn't like catch what the protagonist was saying, can figure out like from the written part, or like, also if you don't understand the language, it's useful, so...
Bad sound for some reason.
Bad sound, yeah.
And also, if you have the written text, it becomes a transcript of an event. So you also have a transcript already at hand that you might use. For training courses, it's becoming more and more common to have, again, captions so that they become a transcript of a training session. These are some of the basic principles behind creating captions. Accuracy. This is a main issue, especially when it comes to live subtitles. Live subtitles are produced more and more frequently by re-speaking. You know what this is? The technique is... the way it works these days is, well, there's a chat show, for example. We are discussing whatever issue here, and there's a guy in a booth that repeats into a microphone what we are saying, all of us. So he re-speaks what is being said by condensing, like deleting repetitions, little things here and there. The system recognizes the voice and turns the voice into written text, and then you can edit it, but very quickly. We have that in every country. We have it in Italy. I'm sure you have it in France and in all the countries for live shows, for example. What you notice is that when it's live, there's a delay, which means I'm saying it's a great day today, and the caption matching what I say will pop up like 5 seconds later, because you need time to revoice that and maybe some minor editing. And accuracy is a huge problem when it comes to live subtitles, because, you know, there's so many different voices and so many different accents, so that the system, even if I am a very good speaker and speak very clearly into the machine, something gets lost, like names, place names, or, you know, politicians or whatever. So, but you want to make sure that your subtitles, captions are accurate, and what you delete for reasons of space and time is not essential to understand the main facts. Clarity when it comes to caption refers to give your users all the information they need to understand who's talking and where the information is coming from. Is if it's from a microphone, from television, from him or from you or from myself. Hmm? And if there's noise that is important, like you saw earlier on, sighs in brackets, or like door slamming or whatever, you want to give all the information so that the product is as clear, comes through as clearly as possible. Consistency, what do you think this refers to?
To have it quite spread out so that there aren't bits that are empty and then other bits that are packed with information.
Yeah, so you want to use like a regular style and pace. Mm-hmm. And also, if you use tags for sounds, or for names, for people, you want to be consistent. Like if you use Elena, for me, it has to be Elena throughout. You don't want to turn it into the Giovanni or ADG or whatever acronym or anything. And if it's noise that is repeated in a film or a series, you want to use size all the time and not change that, so that the deaf person recognizes it. And non-speech information, I think someone mentioned it yesterday. How do you decide what non-speech information is important to provide? Size, earlier on, was it important? Well, what you really want to have is all the noises that are part of the story. Like if a phone rings and it breaks, it interrupts a meeting, that's something you want to say. Mm-hmm. If it's something in the background, if you have space, you can add the tag. If not, what do you think?
I was thinking just now about Tomorrow Morning with Mother, the movie of Aronofsky, where the sounds is fundamental, but also the Sorrentino's movies, in every scene there is a peculiar sound that really match with the visual part. So I think it's really hard also to explain it. It's kind of impossible. An experience, but a fair experience, but the total experience, but also with the visual part is really difficult. So accessibility, I was thinking that accessibility in general could make things simple, but could not provide really the total experience in some ways.
Very often, then again, if you think of our own experience with films, Tarantino or whoever, I'm not sure that we get all the same amount of information. Mm-hmm. For example, if you're an expert or a Tarantino lover or great fan or a lover of cinema, you are more sensitive and careful about all the sound details and things, whereas maybe average audiences skip quite a few details. So that's something we also want to bear in mind, that not all the stimuli that we receive from a film we really get.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that for example the sounds, for the visual part but for the sounds it's unconscious.
Yeah.
Because there is a tension in the movie that you don't reconnect to the sound, but then if you think about it you can realize, otherwise you can also not realize it, but you feel the tension in the case.
Yeah. So were you there for M, the screening of the film yesterday?
Yeah.
I was here last night to have dinner with the film crew, and they were asking us what we thought of the subtitles, because they were saying we found that it's difficult. This film is so difficult to translate because of all the stuttering and things, plus all the play on sounds and the M for Monday. Yeah. That is mercoledì in Italian, which is Wednesday, and all of that. So they were asking us, do you think it really comes through as it is?
I thought it was great. Yeah, I thought it was really good.
The subtitles?
I thought they were great.
The English ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Italian subtitles were different, though. There were differences. There's this reference I remember. They mentioned, I think they say school and college in French, which is l'école et le collège. And then in English it goes school and university, which is the American way. College in American English is used for university. The Italian says...
Also, though, collège in French is middle school.
Yeah. So, anyway, whatever is the correct translation, English said university, definitely, which is the American way. The Italian said... something that is school and high school. Scuola e liceo. So it's a different thing. That happens with translation, something gets lost. What I noticed, because, it's my kind of... And they made me realize that they were aware of the fact that the stuttering and all the play on sounds and consonants and words was very delicate.
But then again, because I didn't follow any of the subtitles, because I speak French, but the only times that really struck me were actually either the stuttering or the spelling.
Yes.
And it's also a bit, it's always a bit strange when there's spelling to see which word goes with, the same word in another language, but I thought it was really well executed in terms of stuttering.
And yeah, stuttering. Actually, I speak French and I understand it, so I didn't really read through the subtitles. But I thought they were condensed enough, which means you can look at the images and read them, and you know, it's not just getting stuck to the subtitles. So, whatever. Well, if you want some reference to have a look at principles behind writing captions, there's a link there for you. You will have the presentation. So, in terms of going creative, this is one of the 1,000 examples that you also mentioned. Is this going to work? Tell me if there's anything you don't like or you particularly like.
You know what you're hearing, so.
I think when it's like a close-up, they don't really say anything, I think.
It's literally only the sounds you can deduce because you see the action and you know what it would sound like.
But if someone is deaf,
off-screen.
If someone is deaf, like, and they have been forever, they might not.
No.
Yeah, like so it's not useful.
But I thought it was not about just knowing what sound is. Is there, but to know what actually happens and
it's more about the action than the sounds.
Yeah, I think so. The idea is to make sure that you don't lose anything in terms of action. Mm-hmm. So, like fridge opens and fridge closes, you don't really see that. You see that he's moving, and you see his back and maybe the hand doing a movement that might make you think of a fridge, but you don't see that. So, and the gurgle is interesting. Because you cannot really deduce it from the images, whereas when it's in the foreground and he's pouring coffee, you can probably imagine this is happening. I think that's the choice behind it. What about the music?
Well, it's not a description of the music. It's just a song. So if you don't know the song, you have no idea what to play.
You probably don't.
So it would be better to say something like happy tune.
Yeah, but that's your own idea, you know. Whereas if you say "Walk on the White Side" by Lou Reed, is you're not saying this is a happy tune or something. Plus, what I found, if you talk to a deaf person, most of them would say, "Well, we know what music is like," and you know, they would tend to say, "We want that because it's what you have, the full information." And then if you tell me it's Lou Reed, I can go and retrieve the music by myself with my own tools or whatever. They tend to be very picky. Like, you know, I don't want your interpretation of it. I want the information, and then I decide what to do with it. Whatever we might want to say. It's interesting that it pops up. When the music stops, it goes, and then it pops up again when the music starts again. So it's like saying, it's here again. I was thinking about music and how important it is in films very often, like Three Billboards that we mentioned yesterday. The music is so important there, isn't it? And even the words in the songs, they are sort of part of the story.
Most of the accent and everything.
Yeah, yeah. So, how do you go about it?
Hmm. Well, when there are lyrics, you can just write them.
Yeah. And most of the time...
They do that, actually. Yeah. They did that.
Very rarely, though.
They did have the lyrics of the song in the end.
Only in the
subtitles?
Yeah.
I don't remember, actually. Yeah, did they? Sometimes,
generally in films it's very rare.
Yeah, I think if the text is really important, so
yeah.
It's really
like
important.
Musical
everyone
films.
That
was interesting. Yeah, especially like a final scene when the two of them are going and in the car and they want to go and kill the guy. There's this song. That is, you know, you can hear it. I don't think they have subtitles there, but the words are sort of connected. So
So Lino Pete was the same.
Oh, I haven't seen.
No, it was when it cut to black.
Yeah,
it just went on. Well, obviously, because the can you combine in some sort of way both the captions and the subtitles when there's speech over a song? You won't have both, but then it cut to black, and the captions.
Plus, there's a certain amount of written information that you can process in certain amount of time. You cannot have like, you know, long lines. I told you that very minimum is 1.12 seconds and maximum 6 seconds. But in those 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 seconds, there's only so much text that you can put and read, possibly. You know, so something you have to do without. And again, we lose something. But let's switch on to blindness. Now, we'll play a game. We're moving on from captions to audio description for blind. And I told you.
As the woman's head sinks beneath the water, the man drops the net into the floor and runs
what
towards
happens?
The back door.
Oh God!
Well, that's what it's supposed
that's
to
intense.
Be. There's a ghost in my computer, but the ghost knew that I was going to do this. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play an audio clip from The Hours, the film. You all know it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the audio soundtrack of the film, no images. And I want you to... Have you seen the film?
Yeah.
Recently?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ah, no, that's not good. But, well, if you haven't seen it recently, even if you have, try to imagine the action with as many details as possible. Well, that was the audio description, Emma. But this is what we want.
Somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like he's in the forest or something.
I didn't get that.
Well, there's leaves on the... There's footsteps on the
leaves. There was music, yeah. That's all I got.
There's also... Well, there's this large part in the middle where you have just mainly the music and minor sound, or what sound to me like minor sound, that very difficult to decode.
But for a film like this, it's really difficult, actually, because it has
for
a lot of cuts.
Film.
And yeah, but I think especially this one, because the opening sequences there, if I remember them well, the cuts are really complicated even to follow when you can see them.
Yeah.
But just... Because the audio mix isn't that different in contrast.
Very good point. With audio description, you have to make sure that you mark cuts, like second scene or different scene. You start out, like if you were writing screenplays, really, you say, morning, inside the house, this and this is happening. Like you create a new context when you switch to a different scene. Otherwise, you might not have any
idea. And do audio descriptions start that way within your scene? Do they describe, like, location, time period?
Kind of? You try not to do it too technically.
Yeah, because, I mean...
Like you say, for example, on the beach in the morning, Martha and John are walking. Hmm? You know, like, telling a story, really. I have another film that we normally use for this. I'm sure you don't know this one.
Yeah, I know it.
You know it? Yeah.
Like it.
Did you like it? Well, this was presented here, precisely, at the Giornate degli Autori a few years back. Terra Ferma.
It's definitely better comparison to the one of this year.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've just seen two, and actually, I don't know. Well, that one was a very good one, I think.
Yeah.
It's an Italian film, and it revolves around all the immigrants coming from Africa, basically.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so that's what it is about. Very touchy film. Like, it's a real thing.
The photographers.
Yeah. Now. Game several times and I get all sorts of feedback. But I think here the sound was quite good and clear. So
the boat
and the chopper. I mean, it feels like an alternation between like a boat and a helicopter viewing from above.
Like it starts with birds, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What birds?
Seagulls. Maybe a fishing boat.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Fishing. I think it's fishing boat on the sea. And then they unload the stuff because they are back somewhere.
They're talking about nets.
Yeah.
They are
okay.
In Sicilian, which is not very clear to us either. But it's like they talk about the nets. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then
speedboats, something like that.
I thought it was a helicopter, but I guess the engine sounds quite
thin. Yeah, so. Good though. Shall we have a look at this one?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh no, yeah. Let's do this. Okay,
you should have VLC. If you have
I
VLC.
Know, but it's not
it's
like
it's
the.
There.
Yeah, well. I'm gonna read
playing.
Because the sound, I mean, the seascape is actually quite clear. But the whole thing about dancing on the boat, no. And it's very, very important because they go from happiness because they've been fishing a lot, so they have a very good catch, as you've seen, from despair because they've started seeing corpses. When the clip finishes, they go like, what is that? And they actually see death. Bodies floating in the water. So it goes from happiness to what is this? And it's very important for the film. It's when they start finding dead people in the water. So again, these are what I think. I keep thinking that for good audio description, you want to be a good film reader. You have to be able to identify important elements, and I don't know why this was got closed, but anyway, this was where we were. Just a few thoughts that I wanted to share about film and vision. A film is strongly pictorial, it is, maybe in different ways, different degrees. Some films are more pictorial than others, as you well know. And as observers, we can act because we make choices. We have all the information coming to us simultaneously. So we have the images, we have the sounds, we have the dialogue, and we make a choice. I once talked about audio description with a film director who was here in Venice a couple of 3 years ago, and he asked me, what is audio description? So I sort of tried to explain, and he said to me, most difficult bit seems to be that you have to give linearity to information that you get all in one go in a film. You don't have that. Like, you have all the information coming to you together, and you make your own selection and process, you know, you process the information. Whereas with audio description, you have to prioritize information and put them one after the other. So it really changes.
Since you work with blind people, do you think that they appreciate the audio description? Do they like this kind of entertainment?
Yeah.
Because of, like, a book would maybe be easier to perceive, no?
Well, you know, 99% of them would tell you, I want what you get. So why can you have that and I can't? I can have my books and that's okay. We've had this huge complaint on public television in Italy because instead of audio describing TV series or films, the main TV station dedicated a special website to blind people with special, like, documentaries that they described. But they said to them, they kept telling them, you know, we want the real thing. We don't want this, like, you know, celebrating Italian unification and special products for them. They say we want to be able to follow news reports, films that you get to see, TV series, you know, otherwise there's no point. So
Wasn't there actually a recent film, I guess it's from last year, but I haven't seen it, so I can't really talk about it. It's called Notes on Blindness.
Yes.
And I'm not exactly sure what it is, but my understanding is that it's really made so that blind people can kind of feel it, not that it doesn't have image, but it's just really strongly conceived to be heard more than...
I think it was also sponsored or hosted by the New York Times. You can find Notes on Blindness on the New York Times website. They hosted it with an interview to the director. And Notes on Blindness was also made accessible with audio description and subtitles. It's a very interesting experience to have so that you realize, you know, more about the way blind people perceive it. This is something interesting I wanted to share with you. Over the past year, I've been taking part in research projects aiming to possibly define what you need to give blind people in audio description. I mean, how do you make selection? So the starting point of all this research was, let's see how sighted people like us prioritize information when they look at films, moving images. So we did this experiment a few years back across countries, Italy, Poland and Spain. We wanted to see if people in different countries and cultures look at things in the same way, which is like, can we define a common core for audio description all over the world? Because nowadays what you do is you don't translate audio descriptions. You do them in Italy, in the Netherlands, in all countries. You redo them. So we chose Marie Antoinette because it's very rich in visual details. And so we wanted to see if, first of all, how sighted people prioritize information, how they go about selecting visual information. And secondly, if this is equal across cultures and countries. So in this case, we were very curious. And these are some of the results that we got, Italy and Spain. So normally, to help you decode this, these like lines identify the main areas for research, but as you can see, the main interest goes to faces. And these are slightly different sequences, like maybe it's a matter of seconds, I think, a couple of seconds, because it looks more or less the same. But in Italy, you have concentration on the face of a lady, whereas for Spain, concentration goes to the man's face. I'm not saying it, you know, because it can get really worse, but I'll tell you. But mainly what happened was in the three countries, even Poland, they would look at the faces because this is what normally helps you get the information, because they are talking. And then your eyes would normally go to the center of the screen, because that's like automatic, kind of, you know. So you look at the centerpiece, and then you go and look at what they are doing, so their action. Action coming from the mouth, action coming from what they are physically doing, which is eating. Like the lady is looking at her plate and saying something, and she's eating her carrots or asparagus or whatever. So there's a sequence that we can identify there. Going back to this, I deleted some of the images, but I can tell you that what we found at the end of the whole research on Marie Antoinette that went on for months is that there's some recurrent patterns. So if there's a moving image, like a pan shot, what you do is you don't just go to the middle of the screen, but you try to foreground the movement. So if movement goes this direction, your eye would sort of go and anticipate. And that's something we all do in France, Spain, Switzerland, Bulgaria, Cyprus. Then there were differences across cultures. Like Italians tend to go for details. So there was this scene where the lady is drinking from a glass, and it's like a side shot. Like close-up side shot of her drinking champagne. And we had Poland just looking at her face and the glass, which is, it's her doing the action of drinking. Spain, her, the glass, some of her bracelets, and that's it. Italy, pearl, the glass, the bracelets, the earrings, and there's a ribbon here. It was this, it came out as something that, you know, happens more frequently in Italy than in other countries as well. And we did several experiments to make sure that this was some, you know, just not occasional. But apparently we have a tendency to go for details. And if you do the same kind of experiment with men and women, it's men that are more essential and women that more go detailed, and travel around a lot for details. Yeah. This is another experiment that we did after Venice. This was a film that was screened here at the Venice Film Festival, and it's an Italian film. I think it was screened in 2010. And, it was also audio described. At the Venice Film Festival for 3-4 years, I think, they had accessibility just on some films. And this film is interesting because it has a long chase. A character is running away from another, and there's this chase. So the guy that you see there, he's running away from another one. So he runs over some stairs into a shopping arcade, goes into a store that sells home appliances, down the staircase again, outside, goes into the tube station, jumps into the train. So there's a sequence of action, and there's no dialogue. Just a music going, so not very interesting, okay? And it's about a minute and a half. But the chase is very important for the film. And it ends with the guy running after this one, saying, oh, something like, fuck you, because he manages to run away. The audio description that had been done for Venice wasn't quite good. So it said something like, the actor is named Sergio, so I'll use Sergio. Sergio runs away. He goes down the stairs, and then he goes out of the shopping arcade. And so the blind, we did tests with the blind, and they were telling us, he goes out of the shopping arcade? Did he ever go in? You know, like there's something missing there. And then we tested the traditional audio description, and they said, he's in the train, but how did he get into the train, you know? So we realized that the way you prioritize information and you put one after the other is very important. So if you want to describe the chase, not all of it, you have to make sure that your links fit together. Then we produced an audio description based on these texts, the way eyes move over the screens. These dots identify eye movements. So we created audio description based on that and tested it with the blind, and there were no missing links because, you know, the eyes of people like us, about 40 people, follow the whole path. They don't skip a passage. And then the blind said, okay, now I understand. So he gets into the shopping arcade, then into the store, down the staircase, and then outside, and covers himself with a newspaper, and then he enters the tube station, and so on. So we used this, like feedback from people that can see, to produce audio description, and it helped us identify the way you have to prioritize information.
Excuse me, I'm actually quite interested what the technology is behind the tracking.
You want to know?
I do.
We have several, even at my university now. These are called eye trackers, and these are tools that come in different shapes. We have one that is, you can fit it on screens, different types of screens, so you can fit it there or here on my computer or a TV screen, and a person would sit in front of it, and what the eye tracker does, it records your eye movements and fixations.
But from where? From the perspective of the screen?
Yeah.
It's like a camera, basically.
Yeah, it's here. It's got a camera that records your eye movements. And pairing it up with the clip or the film that you're watching. And so what it does is this. You have different visualizations, obviously. This is one of the most typical ones because you have the intensity of the fixation. If the ball, like the circle, is bigger, it means there's longer fixation there. And then you have the path. I mean, means the eye goes, and then it does that. And there's a different type that we also acquired last year, and it comes in form of glasses.
That's what I was thinking.
It's not good for movies, though. It's good for, like, you want to see how people move around this space, that's very good, because it's got two sets of cameras. One that records your field of action, and one that records your own eyes on the field of action. So with films, that becomes very tricky, because every single person will have a different experience. Whereas with this, you just sit in front of it, and it's the same clip, and it's just the eyes that travel differently. Very useful. It's very useful for, even for, I think it's good for, it would be great for filmmakers to know how people watch films. Yes. This is another just very quick reference to a study that we did. I'll just tell you that on the left-hand side you have Britain, and on the right-hand side you have Italy. Well, the idea was not to find out that Italians prefer details, again, because we sort of knew. The idea was to, which we did, study how people engage with films in the original version in the UK, with users of the original version and with the dubbed version in a country where they watch a dubbed version. Because we thought, you know, voice type, intonation, volumes, everything might influence the way you look at the film. And it's true. Totally. Yeah. Plus, with dubbing, you replace the whole soundtrack. You don't just replace the voices. You know, it really changes. And it did turn out that that's a huge difference. But, I don't want to go into details, but this was just to show you that in exactly the same moment, the British ignored the breakfast, and the Italians loved breakfast.
But how do you know why it is then? How do you know if it's only because Italians are looking for details, or is it because the soundtrack changed? How can you know?
Yeah, well, in this case, there's no noise, just the two voices. And it's a very static scene. You have to interpret, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe you might be right, but you might also make a mistake. In this case, I don't know if you know the film. What is it?
Grand Budapest Hotel.
This scene here doesn't really have that much. It's a very static scene where they talk to each other. So it goes from side shots to you know, close-ups of the two of them. And then we gave people questionnaires, that's another thing. And we asked them to describe what they remembered. And for example, we got a lot of lipsticks and earrings for Italy, for some reason. What we found out is also that the type of voice really influences the way you look at the film. I think it's also a matter of authenticity. In the original, you know that Ralph Fiennes is using his own voice. In the dubbed version, another main issue that came out and we knew is that when you watch a dubbed version, you look at the mouth a lot. And the eyes are like secondary. When you watch a dubbed version, you tend to ignore the mouth and prefer the eyes. Because you sort of implicitly know that the mouth is tricky and it's a fake. So, and that came out, you know, on all the tests that we did. Like, for the British, you have 70% of fixations on the mouth and 30% on the eyes. And for Italy, it goes down to like less than 40% for the mouth, and the rest is mainly the eyes, and then you travel around also. It's called suspension of disbelief. You know that this is a fake, and you just go with it, but prefer the...
But then again, how do you compare those? So in this case, when you show it to people from the UK, is the original version, but you show the dubbed version to the
Italians.
Do you think that's a fair kind of...
What we did is, in the UK, we had a sample of people from 18 to 30. Same number of men and women in the UK, and same in Italy. I think it was 35 and 35, or whatever. And in the UK, they watched the original version, which is what they get in cinemas and television. And in Italy, we gave them the dubbed version, which is what they get in cinemas and television. Well, you know, in order for us researchers to be sure about findings, you need to repeat the tests. You know, something that was very interesting was that we wanted to test reaction to written text on screen. There's a lot of written text on screen in this film. Like, there's I don't know if you remember it, but there's a newspaper that comes and tells Ralph Fiennes that the lady is dead. And it's a very quick sequence. Like the newspaper has headline, and then at the center of the page you have an article that says Countess Dowager found dead, and there's a picture. And so you have the main title, picture, and then the article. And my initial thought was that, as an Italian, since there's no translation provided, and the newspaper is in English, you would go for the picture. Mm-hmm. Just, you prefer the picture. You know that the words are not your own language, so you sort of skip them. Whereas what came out is that the English would follow regular pattern. So they go from main headline to headline for the piece of news, look at the image, and then start reading the text. The Italians go from the main headline, moving around. Then when it goes down, their eyes go frantic, like they start moving from here to there, because they try to make sense of the text, jumping, skipping bits, and then coming back, and they don't really have the time to look at the image, because it's a quick sequence. So when we ask them questions, like, what's happening, what does the newspaper tell the protagonist, they say that the lady is coming, or that someone died, without having had the time to look at the face, so it really gets lost. But that was like extra. Well, let's have this. Like special effects that I don't normally like. These are some of the definitions that have been given by colleagues of mine to define the description. That it's a verbalization of the visual cause, that it's descriptive narration, additional commentary, and so on. But I just wanted to close on this. Audio description always comes to you in the third person. You never say, I do this, or you do this. It's always an external voice that describes. And you use the present tense. You don't say, he sat on the chair and told the story. He sits and reads the newspaper. He stands up and goes, leaves the room, like that. Sentences should not be too long or long-winded. Why?
Otherwise, you lose like the pace.
Yeah. One. Two, there's a human being, a voice talent, that has to be able to read that. So it's, if a sentence is too long, it goes like...
Okay.
And also, for the blind person to process it, becomes more tiring. Which doesn't mean that you want to say something, he stands up, takes a glass, pours water. So there's an in-between. Avoid subjectivity at all costs. He looks tired. He looks happy. He looks sad. We would never agree on those, hardly ever. So you would rather want to go for a description of face or, you know, frowning and things. Pay special care in prioritizing relevant information. Do not describe what can be inferred from the soundtrack. And obviously, you don't want to say something like, you can see a glass, we see a house. Now, it's obvious that you're describing what you can see, and I cannot see, so thanks. Or something like, the blind really hate it when you say something like, the phone rings. And I say, I'm blind, I'm not deaf, you know. Actually, I can hear better than you, so... and avoid cinematic terms, like close-up or pan shot. Some companies, or some, in some countries, this is more like common. But normally you want to avoid those. Why?
Because not everyone
is more technical and less emotional.
And not everyone might understand. Yeah, it's like going to a cinema. We know what a pan shot is and what, you know, a close-up or medium close-up is, but not everyone does. So that's it. Shall we try and quickly describe the hours? Do you have 5 minutes? So now I'm going to play the clip from the film.
So with no sound, I guess.
With sound and images, the normal thing.
So we describe that.
Yeah, let's see how you would describe. Ah. Well, this was used by a friend in Catalonia, as you can see. For the lady, I think that's enough.
Should we start after the title? Or?
Yeah, just ignore the titles. What you do with the titles normally with audio description is you read the main ones and then you keep the rest for the end of the film. So just as if you want to pretend that they are not there, okay? Just give it a description of this scene. Shall I play again? Yeah. And then we try to see what is top priority for us. Nice Catalan, that is.
I mean, we should ignore the first few shots, right? Because they're not...
This. I think you have to describe this. Yeah, not very clear.
Sunny day in 1951, Los Angeles.
That's something you need to say.
A man parks his car in front of his house, exits the car carrying a bouquet of flowers, and enters the house. Leaves the bouquet on the
kitchen.
On the kitchen, yeah, whatever, not a table, but a kitchen bar, and walks towards.
What about the van that we get to see?
Yeah. I think. Do we?
We don't need it for the story, I think, but you would need to explain maybe how Los Angeles looks like,
yeah.
The particular sub
the
palm
area.
Area. Yeah,
maybe the palm trees.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Palm trees.
They're telling more about the environment than the retro.
Yeah, sunshine.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And that it's
you
like
said that.
It's like this little all these houses, so they're not in a deserted area, but like you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's like a bourgeoisie kind of environment. And what else? She's in bed. Is she asleep?
Yeah.
Awake?
She is asleep.
She sort of smiling or moving.
We could just say eyes closed. So
yeah. We don't really know if she's sleeping or not, do we? What do you think?
So she's gone. Yeah, closed eyes, but kind of shivering, but kind of.
Not like fast asleep, not sleeping heavily. You know what I was thinking, well, that I haven't mentioned yet? When you audio describe a film, first thing you want to do is you want to watch the whole film.
Yeah.
Which is something that you should do even when you translate it. It's always recommended.
So you can know which details are important.
Also,
and whether you should describe the van, for instance.
Exactly. That's one thing. And if she's sleeping or not, or pretending, you need to know before you set describing. Another thing that you want to realize is if there's something you don't have to disclose, like someone's identity, might be kept as a mystery for some reason. So instead of giving the man's name, what you normally do with characters is to say a man in his 50s, wearing a suitcase and a tie and brown trousers, is walking, blah, blah, blah. The, Jason, the man, and then you give the name and surname. But if it has to remain hidden for some time or throughout the film, you want to know. So, you want to hear the audio description?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a fast one, this one. It's a British official. Oh, no, sorry. I have to... This is just audio. It's very fast.
As the woman's head sinks beneath the water, the man drops the letter to the floor and runs towards the back door. The woman's body, face down, is carried by the swift current through swaying reeds along the murky riverbed. Her gold wedding band glinting on her finger, her shoes slipping off her foot. The Hours, based on the book by Michael Cunningham, screenplay by David Hare, music by Philip Glass. In Los Angeles in 1951, a removal van drives past a row of neat single-story homes. Tall, regimented palm trees line the street, their shadows slant across pavements and lawns. A car with white wall tires pulls into the driveway of one of the houses and the driver gets out. Dressed in grey slacks, an open-necked white shirt over a white vest and carrying a bunch of yellow roses, he goes in through the front door of the house and closes it carefully behind him. Dan Brown is in his mid-30s with dark hair and thick eyebrows over a fleshy, snub-nosed face. He puts the flowers down on the kitchen counter, glances at his watch, crosses to a bedroom, and peeps in around the open door. With a faint smile at his wife, Laura, who lies in bed on her side asleep, he turns away. Laura, who has wavy reddish brown hair, stirs, but does not wake.
Wow.
Richmond.
That's a lot of information.
I thought that was good, but I thought it was great. I'm wondering, do we know at this point whether it's Laura, his wife? Is that like a given that we know, or does he kind of give it away before it's actually been?
If a man walks into a house with a key and he watches someone sleep, you kind of, I think, assume.
Or about.
I would assume that it was his wife.
I'm sure that in the film it's not important to keep it as a secret. And since in this film you have different levels of narration with different characters, perhaps you want to make sure that they are identified earlier in the story. It's very dense.
And actually, in this movie, you have that Julianne Moore plays more than one character.
Exactly.
So how did they do it?
Yeah.
And it was important that it was
the
same.
Yeah, you define the identities in this case. It's very dense because in Britain, they're very used to audio description, so they do it in, you know, with a lot of text in it. In different countries, that doesn't happen. Like in Italy, that wouldn't be acceptable. But that's the way it was done in the UK.
Is it theoretically possible to audio describe every film?
Good question. I think my only experience of not finding it in any way possible to audio describe a film was in Torino for the film festival a few years back. That was this documentary film about workers in northern Italy. It was more of a documentary. And they were talking all the time. All the time. No space. So we found ourselves trying to describe the very beginning by foregrounding some information. And then after 10 minutes, we had like 3 seconds. And what's the point, you know? Without a description, you have to sort of create links between the descriptions. But if there's no space, what's the point? So we said, we think this is virtually impossible to describe, you know, so why don't we choose something else? And again, accessible filmmaking should tell directors that if they want that film to be accessible for everyone, there should be some kind of break in between. That was like constant dialogue, so not possible.
Because, for instance, like, I think musicals must be very hard. Like, for example, La La Land, it has, like, this music which keeps coming back, and that gives you a certain feeling, but if you can't hear it...
What's what you described, though, so I've never heard about the description.
I would be curious for that one.
You know what is very difficult? Animation. There's never silence in animation. So it's either dialogue or sound effects or music. No break. So what you do is you cover up some of music or some of the sound effects, like lowering volumes and inserting the descriptions. And all animation is described. Like, I have Despicable Me 1 and 2 here with all descriptions. It's actually a good one, but very tough.
Like, how do you describe the Minions?
Yeah, well, that's...
That's fine.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was thinking about the sounds to, like, someone who can hear it.
Yeah, well, I have this Despicable Me 2 here, like a short clip, and it's a good audio description also because when it comes to kids, you want to be a bit, you don't want to have a neutral voice. You normally interpret it because, you know, otherwise you really spoil the entertainment. Can you imagine the Minions and all that they do, and then the description goes, the Minion moves left on the left, and then he sits down. So it's a bit like acting, really, which is good. I can play it like very quickly, just 2 seconds of it. There's even better descriptions, but this is quite good actually.
Sunlight starts to illuminate the darkened earth. Light sparkles on the landmasses of the earth as it spins in space. A gold and silver letter in the name Universal encircles the center of the spinning globe. A Comcast company. Two little yellow characters, Minions, stand by white letters that read Illumination Entertainment. One has two eyes, the other one. The two Minions fight. The one-eyed one pushes the two-eyed Minion off screen. Universal Pictures presents a Chris Meledandri production. In big red letters, with the silhouette of a hook-nosed man between the M and E, Despicable Me 2. Steve Carell, Kristen Wiig, Benjamin Bratt, Miranda Cosgrove, Russell Brand, Steve Coogan, Ken Jeong. A frozen wasteland. A yellow snowcat vehicle heads towards an isolated base. The hexagonal central complex is surrounded by numerous outbuildings. A caption. Top secret research laboratory, Arctic Circle. Two workers in fur-lined coats and hats are sitting outside playing cards on a metal barrel. One holds up the five of diamonds, then flicks out four aces from behind it. Coins they were betting with rise up into the air.
I know you like it, but...
It's actually very good.
Yeah. And the voice is nice, too.
It's like acting, but not pushing it too far. Sort of matching the film. And it's good, yeah. And leaving... I mean, they don't cover what's important in terms of sound, so it's good, yeah. This is a good one. I remember I bought two DVDs to choose one good audio description for animation, and the other one was the Smurfs, and that was very boring. Like, again, it's very lively and it's for kids, and the audio description goes, the Smurfs move and they sit down. This is a failure. Whereas this one is good, so... Okay, that's the end of it.
And the email?
Yes, absolutely. Perhaps you can write your name, surname, and email, and I'll email everything.
Fred Film Radio,
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.